Good afternoon and welcome to the continuation of the Next Evolution of Health Summit. It's been a great adventure so far, and I hope you people get a chance to listen to the recordings of the ones you missed, because they've been filled with fantastic insights and wonderful stories and heartwarming advice. It's been really a great journey so far. So, and then I have the pleasure now to introduce our guests for the next hour and a half, and they're going to be speaking about the neuroscience of well-being. So we're going to go deeper into the science of well-being and some of the emerging neurobiology around that. So first off, Cassandra Veaton is a licensed clinical psychologist, and she's also the director of research at the Institute of Noetic Sciences and co-director of the Mind-Body Medicine Research Group at California Pacific Medical Center Research Institute. She's also the co-president of the Institute for Spirituality and Psychology, which obviously is going to keep her fairly busy. She's done numerous studies in a whole range of areas for the National Institute of Health, the state of California. She's worked on the biological and psychological underpinnings of addiction and alcoholism, and has a PhD in clinical psychology and authored many books. Really quite an extraordinary bio for a relatively young age. So, Kathy, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Stephen.
Hi. Great. Welcome. And joining her on this panel, we have Rick Hansen, who is a neuropsychologist and founder of the Wellspring Institute for Neuroscience and Contemplative Wisdom, as well as the author of the best-selling Buddha's Brain, the Practical Neuroscience of Happiness, Love, and Wisdom. He's a summa cum laude graduate of UCLA. He's been featured on BBC and NPR and been an invited presenter at universities like Oxford, Stanford, and Berkeley. He's basically an expert on the self-directed neuroplasticity, which he edits the Wise Brain Bulletin and has a weekly newsletter called Just One Thing. He's also currently a trustee of Saybrook Institute and a member of the board of the Tricycle Foundation. So, Rick, thank you so much for joining us here today.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Great. And our final guest is Michael Spezio, who's the assistant professor of psychology and neuroscience at Scripps College and the visiting faculty in affective and social neuroscience at the California Institute of Technology. His research looks at how the brain contributes to empathic, moral, and political cognition and action. The focus includes the contemplative practices on these processes on the mind. He's a research director of the Center for Engaged Compassion at the Claremont School of Theology, as well as an ordained minister and the co-editor of several upcoming books. So welcome, Michael Spezio, to this program.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here. Thanks very much.
Great. Well, I'm going to just more or less turn this over to Cassie as the moderator and let the three of you explore this subject material. But Cassie, how did you want to start things off?
Well, I am just so happy to be here with my friends and colleagues, Rick and Michael. And thanks for being willing to come on a Sunday. I know it's a good cause, and it's also an interruption to the Sunday afternoon, so I really appreciate you being here. And I think the thing I wanted to start with was to say that, you know, the thing that's most interesting to me right now in the neuroscience of well-being is that it's not a one-way street. We're not just being affected by our genes. We're not just being affected by our gene expression. We're not just being affected by our brains. But we are also affecting our brains. And I'd like to start with Rick and ask you, when we talk about the neuroscience of well-being, what would you have to say, first of all, about this two-way street where it's not just that our brains affect how we perceive and how we behave and how we feel, but what we intend and what we think also affects our brains?
Sure. Well, I think what's useful for people to appreciate is the really dramatic and mounting every month pile of solid research papers that demonstrate what's called experience-dependent neuroplasticity. In other words, they really show that the fleeting flow of immaterial, non-physical thought, emotion, desire, memory, longing, wishing, fearing, anger, joy, and all the rest of that leave lasting traces in neural structure behind. And to make an oversimplification, but that is fairly apt, it is a little bit like going to the gym. In other words, if you do a little bit of physical exercise, you'll get a little bit of improvement in your muscle. But if you do a substantial amount of work with a particular muscle, and in particular repeat that over time, then gradually that muscle will grow, and as it grows, so will the functional capacities associated with that particular muscle. It's much the same in the brain. For example, as Michael knows, a fairly landmark study done by Sarah Lazar and colleagues showed that long-term meditators have a measurable thickening of cortical tissue. In other words, they have lots more synapses and blood flow associated with regions of the brain that have to do with both the executive control of attention as well as tuning into their own bodies and tuning into their own emotions. And that measurable thickening of neural tissue is associated with improvement in terms of those functions. So, you know, as a famous saying has it from the work of the Canadian psychologist Donald Hebb, neurons that fire together wire together. And they do so for better or worse. You know, if we, the traditional saying in contemplative practice, Buddhism is my own primary background in that regard, is that the mind takes the shape of what it rests upon. More profoundly, it's the brain, really, that takes the shape of what the mind rests upon. So if we rest our mind upon, you know, our complaints and our resentments and our regrets and our self-criticism, you know, the brain will gradually take the shape of depression and pessimism and anxiety and sensitivity to stress and so forth. Whereas on the other hand, if we rest the mind increasingly on the good news of everyday life, the small good things that happen in a day, or a recognition of our own good qualities, the mind will gradually take the shape over time of optimism, resilience, more large-heartedness toward others in the world, and so forth. So it's a very exciting time to be alive. You know, brain science has roughly doubled in its knowledge base in just the last 20 years. So that means that every day there really are new opportunities for people to understand more specifically how to use mental activity alone to change the brain, to change the mind for the better.
And Michael, I'd love for you to just check in now about how your research, I mean, I know that you have done a lot of research on centering prayer and contemplative practices and how the way that people attend to and intend to their lives change their brains or, you know, I mean, some of this is, you know, as we talk about it, I have a conservative point of view that says, okay, we need to be careful about correlations, and we need to know that when we look at whether the amount of practice that someone engages in is correlated to the thickening of the cortex, there haven't really been studies quite yet of longitudinal nature where we look at whether the brain actually thickens over time. Instead, we've looked at correlations between thickening and practice. But I know that you have some experience in how your mental states and how your intentions and your practices and your attention changes the brain. And so let me know what you think about this, Michael.
Right. Thanks very much, Kathy. Just picking up off of what you just said, you're right that I think that we have to be quite cautious but yet optimistic that future work will actually yield directions that would provide evidence for making statements about causality. Right now, that terrific study and the ongoing very exciting work by Professor Lazar and her colleagues it's a terrific study, but as you noted, it was done at a cross-section of time, and in order to demonstrate a causal effect, one would have to begin with people who are naive to any kind of contemplative practice whatsoever and follow them perhaps over 20 or 30 years of doing that practice, because the individuals who were maybe not 20, 30, perhaps 15, the individuals who were recruited for that study who did practice had been teaching, I think on average it was between 15 and 20 years. And so we don't know if right now if the thickening was a result of that practice or whether the differential tissue indices picked up in that study, as Rick was saying, thickening in the insula and in some other areas, whether that thickening was actually partially responsible for bringing those people, attracting those people, making those people more amenable to practices of meditation. My sense of it is that it's perhaps a little bit of both. Perhaps there are dispositions to or genetic and other biological propensities toward greater plasticity. That doesn't mean that those of us who don't have those larger propensities toward brain plasticity won't also tremendously benefit by engaging in these practices. But in my view, we're right at the beginning of this, and I hold out a lot of hope for the future. There's going to be a lot of more exciting work, also work coming out of the University of Wisconsin, out of Professor Richie Davidson's lab, his colleague, Professor Antoine Lutz, and other places around the United States and indeed around the world. Professor Tanya Zinger at the Max Planck Institute in Leipzig. She just moved there and has absolutely tremendous plans to continue her very exciting work linking more secular versions of contemplative practice to the growth and development of empathic and compassionate response toward the suffering of other people. And in this, I'll pick up on what Rick was saying, because I think the way that I very much liked what you said, Rick, and the way that I would perhaps interpret that is that, in fact, part of cultivating a compassionate and empathic mind is actually asks us to, in fact, look at the pain and the suffering of ourselves and others around us, and to not gaze away, but gaze toward, but gaze with new eyes, gaze with a different kind of attention upon those people and upon our own journeys in the places where we might have fallen down, and recognize where we have been helped by having been brought back to our feet, et cetera. I think that it does no one any good to simply look at life and see only and look at only those things that are good, because that can blunt us to the suffering of others. And from my perspective in investigating and also in practicing Christian contemplative practice, the focus on suffering is central to the practice, and the recognition of one's own complicity in the suffering of others, as well as the suffering one has endured that has perhaps blunted one's own sense to how one could be more available to help others. These are central things, not at all to induce guilt, very much opposite to that. It's to bring awareness, to bring the moving through that suffering. So in my view, contemplative practice is as much about seeing the pain in life and responding with creativity, with love, with compassion to that pain, as it is about fostering optimism. And because I think there's a kind of a recursive pattern, one can foster optimism only via engaging the negative in life in a new way, and then moving through that to a place of, I think, better understanding, but also more effective action in order to respond in a loving manner to that suffering. So that's a kind of introduction from where I'm coming from.
Well, thank you, Michael, and I want to hear more detail about your research later. And I think one of the things that has been interesting to me through my studies on transformation and on mindfulness has been almost like a redefining of what well-being means, because it seems as though our culture has promoted this idea of well-being as sort of a high quality of life, a high level of satisfaction, a high level of pleasure, of joy, and these are all true, but I think we're all coming to the conclusion that well-being is actually much deeper than that. It's something that not only attends more closely to the joys and the pleasant emotions and the pleasurable experiences of our lives, but also has a different relationship to the difficult experiences and the challenges that we face. And I'd love to hear more from you, Rick, about that.
You mean about the fundamental nature of well-being?
I think so, because I think in some ways we are redefining what is happiness, what is quality of life, what is well-being. It's from the health perspective, and because this whole teleseminar series is about the next evolution of health, I think the primary focus has been the reduction or elimination of symptoms and the achievement of calmness and contentness, and in some ways that's true, and in other ways it is redefining our relationship to whatever our symptoms are or whatever the challenges and difficulties are in our lives. And we know that the human experience is a constant flow of pleasant, unpleasant, of contentment and disorientation. And I've been thinking a lot about how well-being might be something that is deeper than just the content of our experiences, but has more to do with the relationship that we have toward our experiences.
I think both things are true. I think that fundamentally the relationship people have to what flows through the mind is at the bottom of well-being. And so that's the ultimate safety net, you know, that's the ultimate resort if, for example, what's flowing through the mind is chronic physical pain or just an intractable kind of depression that won't let go, or a background of anxiety or reactivity related to a history of trauma and so forth. On the other hand, second, in addition to our relationship to the contents of mind, I think it's very reasonable for people to think of happiness in terms of positive contents of mind, not entirely positive contents of mind. I don't think that people would not want to feel heartache or sorrow, let's say at the loss of a loved one. But on the whole, when you think about the little list I went through there, you know, in terms of chronic pain or depression or, you know, generalized anxiety disorder or PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, you know, people would, I think, rather have over time, and there's every right to want to have, a growing sense of peacefulness, happiness, love for themselves and others, compassion and so forth. So I think both are true, you know. And what I think about are the people I know and work with routinely. You know, Cassie, a practicing therapist, and I see people day in and day out who, you know, they're angrier than they need to be, you know, and want to be. They're more frustrated than they want to be. They're more caught up in addictions than they really want to be. And I think the opportunity there as well is to, you know, really help people with those contents over time. That's where I think in terms of the sort of model I have of the three stages of any kind of healing or personal growth or even spiritual practice, it's to first be with what's there, and then second, if it's problematic, you know, do what you can to release it. Otherwise, just dwelling on painful material is firing neurons together and gradually wiring them together. And then the third phase is to replace it gradually again over time. Obviously, there are pitfalls in any one of those three stages. People can just be with what's there long past the point of usefulness, or people can also get caught up in trying to release what's there with lots of striving and, you know, aversion to what's there and ego about it and complications. Okay, fine. But just because there are pitfalls in each of those three phases, it doesn't mean we shouldn't engage them. And sometimes it's useful to go to the third phase, which is to internalize positive experiences or other resources, you know, in the very beginning so that people can bear to be with what's there, you know, so that they can actually stay with their own experience without being overwhelmed by it. But anyway, that's helped me. I think the first stage is absolutely fundamental, you know, and I think being with what's there ultimately, depending on one's framework, shades into transcending what's there by resting in the ground that's really always already radiant prior to the contents of mind, maybe even prior to ordinary consciousness. But that said, sometimes just being with what's there is not alone curative. And then I think there's a place for engaging the other two modes. I think maybe to wrap up about the Buddha, you know, who laid out the Noble Eightfold Path, and one of the eight elements certainly is right mindfulness. He was incredibly, you know, devoted to mindfulness and simply being with what's there to a profound degree. But he also dropped in wise effort, you know, right effort, which is basically about pulling weeds and planting flowers in the garden of the mind, and therefore, you know, cultivating wholesome qualities and undoing unwholesome qualities or factors in the garden of the brain. You know, as we start stitching mind and brain more clearly together over time. So that's how I guess that's how I think about it. Kind of a balanced way of looking at it, but one that, you know, definitely appreciates and wants to honor the ways in which people don't want to just change their relationship to the contents of mind, but they actually rightfully have an interest in the contents of mind, if possible, avoiding pitfalls, improve for the, you know, get better.
Thanks, Rick. This is a great paradox. I mean, I think this is something that I've come upon in the last 10 years of my research on how people transform their lives to happier and more meaning-filled and more altruistic and compassionate ways of being. And one of the paradoxes is kind of what we're illuminating here, which has to do with there's a way that we are being asked by the universe to go with the flow, to let go, to be with what is, to meet it exactly as it is with mindfulness. And there's another way that we're being asked to every day set our intention toward wholesome and in some ways really utilize our will toward what is positive and what is healthy and what is compassionate and healthy and make those choices with agency every day. And those two things seem to be equally true, and it's a very interesting aspect to me of the transformative process. Mike, I wonder if you have anything to say about that in terms of your research on altruism and compassion, and particularly I know that you've been very interested, as I have been, in what Rick said about, you know, sort of paradoxically the way that you are able to tolerate the presentation of one's own or another's suffering also leads to your ability to be altruistic and compassionate about that suffering.
Right. This is a great beginning to this conversation. Really appreciate both the contributions that you, Cassie, and you, Rick, have made thus far. It's very, very stimulating. One way that I'd like to contribute is to outline a little bit about a kind of raging debate that's been ongoing in science about the contributions to behaviors that seem altruistic. So in science, altruism is used to describe a behavior that seems to benefit another person at some cost to yourself. And altruistic behavior does not necessarily entail, if you were able to account for all of the intentions that someone has, it does not necessarily entail that in fact they did act more for the benefit of the other person than themselves. And I'll explain a little bit more about why. So say you see someone in distress and you move to help that person in distress. Now, that looks like, and you've done it at some cost, you've taken your time, perhaps you've even taken your own money and tried to give some help. Maybe you've even placed yourself in danger in order to help that person. The raging debate within science that still will take some time, I think, and will take neuroimaging finally to settle, is whether or not people in general, or whether we have certain people along certain developmental paths, why people would choose to act, why people choose not to act. So say you have a person choosing to act because when they look at the person in distress, they are overcome by a sense of that person's importance to their family, that person's family, to the people who love that person. They're overcome by a sense of the suffering that that person is undergoing from the perspective of that person, and then they move very quickly and then they act. On the other hand, you could have a person who acts just like the other person that I just described, who looks at the person and just thinks, ah, this is absolutely, it's causing me such pain to see this person in distress. And the pain it's causing me, even if they are not consciously aware of that pain is actually causing them to move to help that person. So they're really working in some way that they're not even perhaps completely aware of to ease their own personal distress at the sight of a child who is hungry or at the sight of a person who is otherwise in real need. And that would fit under the description of altruistic behavior, but when you actually did all of the analysis and took account of all of the motivations, that you would see that, in fact, after they did the helping, their own levels of distress would come down, their heart rate would come down, and they'd be much more at peace. And if it's really if it really is the case that they were moved primarily or perhaps only from their motivation for reducing or eliminating their own personal distress at the sight of another person who's suffering, then the question of whether that's true altruism, and that then becomes more of a knotty question. And there is now research that suggests, and this is research done by Paul Slovic and colleagues, showing that if you present a scenario, a scenario involving statistics, a scenario involving a person in trouble, and you ask a person to somehow rate their level of anger or their guilt at not helping, and that rating is high, and then you ask a person to think about, well, how much do you feel compassion toward, or how much do you understand the perspective of that person, and that rating is made, it turns out that It's for most people, it's actually the first rating that co-varies strongly with whether or not they decide to help. Surprisingly enough, their ratings of compassion for the individual, perspective taking for that individual, don't co-vary. They're not at all significant with decisions about whether to help. And this is, I think, one of the ways that contemplative practice and contemplative practice within the domain, when you include it in rigorous programs of neuroscientific research, this is a way to both try to answer this question, that is, does everyone really just act because they want to reduce their own personal distress and they're not at all engaged by the other in relation, in real relation? Is it really just about getting their own mental house clean? Or is it really about that other person? Or, can we identify, A, on the one hand, some people, one might call them virtuous exemplars or, moral exemplars, virtuous people, for lack of a better term, or are there some ways, B, such as contemplative practices like metta, like perhaps centering prayer, Christian compassion practice, yogic practice, are there some ways that we can actually help us all to transform from people acting to immediately reduce our own stress level to people who are not so distressed as much as moved by love for the other in need. So I think that these are very knotty questions. It's very early. It is very early days, but there is some real, as Rick pointed out, there's some real cause to hope that we will have answers to these questions within a very short time. And in science, a very short time generally means maybe 5 to 10 years.
Well, one of the things I find interesting about this conversation is that we've talked a lot about compassion and altruism and empathy. And one of the things that I have found in my research is that when people start their transformative practices, whether they are mindfulness practices or centering prayer or some other form of transformational practice, they start out by being sort of concerned with their own well-being. Many people are drawn to these practices because they're kind of, frankly, tired of their own suffering. And over time, what happens is that they realize that elimination or reduction of their own suffering is inextricably intertwined with the reduction of suffering for not only themselves, but their families and their communities and, you know, at the largest level, all beings. And so, Rick, I wondered if you could talk a little bit about the relationship between compassion and empathy and personal well-being.
Oh, that's great. So, well, okay. So for empathy, I think that what it is essentially simulating the internal world of other people. And to simplify, there are basically three sort of intertwining systems that exist in the human brain that help us do that. One system involving mirror-like neural networks tends to simulate the actions of others, particularly the intentional actions. Second system, centered in the insula, the mirror networks tend to be in the back of the temporal lobes, where the junction with the parietal lobes. In terms of the insula, or rather simulating the emotions of others, that tends to happen more based on activity in the insula. And then last, centered in the prefrontal cortex and really coming online gradually as those regions myelinate, as they add insulation over the course of individual development through the teens and sometimes into the early 20s, are capacities for what developmental psychologists call theory of mind. In other words, simulating, in a broad sense, the thoughts of other people. So we have actions, emotions, and thoughts. You know, people vary in their capacity for empathy, and more fundamentally and importantly, I think, they vary in their motivation for empathy. Empathy itself is morally neutral. It's the foundation of compassion that has traction. But, for example, people who are autistic and lack empathy would not make very good interrogators because they're not capable of really tracking the painful experiences of the prisoner. And thus wouldn't be so effective. Where empathy starts moving into the moral sphere, of course, is when it gets involved in something like compassion, and that's where I think the distinction in Buddhism is practically useful between compassion and kindness, compassion boiling down to the wish that beings not suffer, often accompanied with feelings of sympathetic concern, and kindness being the wish that beings be happy. So compassion presupposes some kind of distress or dysfunction, suffering, broadly defined, in other words, while kindness does not presuppose suffering. One can be kind to others without them needing to be in pain. As to how compassion and certainly empathy link to well-being, I think first empathy links to well-being in the sense that if one is not very capable of tuning into others, one typically is not very capable of tuning into oneself. People have shown that there are overlapping neural circuits that are involved in both attunement for oneself and attunement to others. So in a wonderful kind of two-way street, going back to your notion in the very beginning, Cassie, of a two-way street between mind and brain, as people become more self-aware, they become more capable of awareness of the inner world of others, and learning more about the inner life of others gives them good data that they can use over time to become more aware of themselves. And I think self-awareness is certainly a very important factor of and fruit of well-being, especially a factor of. The second thing is that if, you know, it gets to, I think what Michael was speaking to really eloquently, clearly from the heart in the very beginning about the ways in which, here's how I would kind of elaborate it a little further, the ways in which our own fate is tied up in the fate of others. In other words, our well-being is inextricably tied up with and dependent upon the well-being of others, and so empathy for their world and then compassion, particularly compassion that moves us to action. As some of, as Michael knows, Richie Davidson's work on, you know, the beginning pilot studies on monks, for example, who are activating compassion inside an MRI, also seem to have an increased activation in the motor circuits of the brain. In other words, they were getting ready to help. You know, compassion was moving them to action. Anyway, as we become more able to tune into the inner world of other people, and then we're moved to wish them well, and often accompanied with feelings of sympathetic concern, and then based on that, we take action as we can. You know, and sometimes you can't always take action. It's important to be able to be compassionate, even if you can't do anything about it. But generally speaking, compassion does move us to action. Then based on that action, we help others, we improve their welfare, and then in a wonderful kind of circle, you know, Indra's web, as it were, you know, in the large-scale network that we're all part of on this planet, lonely planet Earth, on the, you know, life raft Earth. Anyway, as we improve their welfare, that swings back over time, ripples back over time to improve our welfare as well and our well-being as well. Plus, I think, you know, altruism, in addition to the ways that it reduces our empathic suffering and the suffering of others, altruism for many people, I think, certainly they report, is subjectively rewarding in its own right. And generosity is rewarding. And, you know, there have been some interesting studies about actually people who got more neural activation giving a certain amount of money to charity than they did keeping it for themselves. You know, the amounts of money were fairly small. Maybe that had something to do with it. But anyway, maybe just because they were college students, who knows. But, you know, doing what we can for others, including just opening our hearts wide to letting them be carried away by compassion, can be experienced, I think, as very rewarding in a very deep way that is also another basis for well-being.
Well, I want to ask you both, maybe starting with Michael, what do we know so far about the kinds of practices that people can engage in that will enhance their own well-being?
If you're asking me about what we know in terms of the neuroscience, I think that there is mounting evidence. So we just completed two studies, one in which we actually had two groups. These are undergraduates, completely naive to contemplative practice. One group practiced metta, and the other group practiced, was a very active control group, practiced mindfulness of breathing practice, and both stemmed and do stem from the same tradition, the same Buddhist tradition, and both were taught by the same teacher who was blind to the hypotheses involved. And what we found is both the mindfulness of breathing and the metta practice increased these individuals' willingness to be generous with real money to other people. And yet, it was the metta practice, much more than the mindfulness of breathing practice, that actually increased levels of trust in other people. So if I'm going to trust another person, this research suggested that metta was more effective, and I should stress, all of these studies that I'll be talking about are incredibly limited by design, by the methods that we use to how, you know, to kind of quantify these results, and none of them are perfect. Most of them are quite imperfect. And our struggle always as scientists is to engage with practitioners, with scholars of these practices to better and better turn our science to the real questions and to the real phenomena that are at central concern for practitioners themselves and for scholars of these practices. I want to stress that at the beginning. So what I will be describing in this context will be, you know, again, very, very small steps, but I think steps that point to ways of greater understanding. So then getting back to the study, in our study, the con- given our context and our limitations, what it would suggest in the limited time, and I want to stress that this was only after 4 weeks from going from naive practitioner, having a session of training just once a week over 4 weeks' time, yet being reporting that people practiced at least 20 minutes a day over those just 4 weeks, what it would suggest is that metta was more effective over that short time than was mindfulness of breathing for increasing the trust that I would feel toward another person, increasing my trust in other people, my esteeming of them as human beings that I can depend on. And this was measured by, again, real money, so it had real consequences. It was not just an as-if rating, and that's an important part of all of this. So that's one study. Another study that we just completed was working with an aging population and showed that, and this was now focusing within the yogic tradition, and one again, an experimental group, a very, very active control group, the same exact tradition, the yogic tradition, one in which the teaching was more traditional and therefore involved relational capacity toward a divinity, and the other which the teaching stressed well-being of self, always focusing on well-being of self. And in this active control study, what we found is that both conditions strongly increased well-being, measured by certain psychometric assessments that are well accepted and validated. But it was stunning to us, and I want to stress that the individuals here were completely naive to contemplative practice. They went through an 8-week training, in this case, same teacher, naive to the hypotheses, taught both practices again, coming from the same tradition, simply altered in this way that I've just described. And the relational group went on to continue practicing after the training was over at a rate that was almost 7 times greater than the rate for the group that really did not have the relationality as a central element to their training. And there were also some very interesting measures with regard to how the relational training group oriented more to the troubles that are in the world around us. And they seemed to display or self-report an increased concern for those troubles than compared to the active control group. But I want to stress that both the relational and the active control group both reported strong increases in measures of well-being. And so these are things we're doing. Professor Davidson's lab, Professor Lutz's work, Professor Slechter is there in the University of Wisconsin at Madison. They also have published great research suggesting that certain practices facilitate well-being. Linda Carstensen, Professor Carstensen, has done this. Professor Al Kazniak at the University of Arizona, and a number of other individuals affiliated with the Mind and Life Institute, which is a fantastic institute supporting lots of this research. And very rigorous research published in solid peer-reviewed journals, mainstream scientific journals, and we could talk about the importance of doing that kind of work. Lots of good evidence that several contemplative practices facilitate this, some perhaps over short periods of time more than others. No one has studied this over the long periods of time that would be necessary to really answer the question of whether one practice is better than another, or how this differs for individuals, and we have to think about that. Also, we're not quite clear yet at all on whether these different practices actually engage the brain differently, or whether they're all making use of a similar type of central, set of central processes. And this is a really interesting question, and especially in view of what Rick just described about mechanisms of the simulation theory of mind. I want to point out, Rick, that there also are theory of mind that involve some of those areas and some other areas as well, and we could talk about that and how contemplative practices might actually bring them in more online, et cetera, in addition to the simulation theoretic systems that you very nicely outlined for us. I think that these questions about whether the practices over the long term are different and whether they're in the short term or long term engaging the same or different processes of the brain because of their different emphases in mind are central to my interest, I think, to the interests of many other researchers in this area.
Well, I think so far we've been speaking, very, in some ways, very abstractly about these ideas about whether attention to self or attention to others or metta practice, which for those of you who are listening is sort of a loving kindness practice where you really focus on extending kindness to other people while you're meditating versus just an attention to the breath increases trust in others and generosity. There's been a little bit of abstractness in the way we're talking, but at the same time, there's a very real everyday application of what we've been talking about. And I love how Rick calls it practical neuroscience. How do we take these neuroscientific findings and apply it to our everyday lives? And I wondered, Rick, if you could talk a little bit more about how, even though it's in its infancy, what is it about what we know about how the mind affects the brain that might influence our well-being in everyday life?
Wow, there's so many examples. I think that it's interesting to consider what the standard of evidence is in different settings. The standard of evidence, I think of the gold standard really as meta-analyses of multiple solid papers or research studies. That's one standard of evidence. Another standard of evidence I think of relates to the quote from the head of the chief medical officer of the Duke Medical Center, which I read a few years ago, in which he said just frankly that 50% at least of what physicians do day in and day out, both in hospital settings and in outpatient settings, the methods they use, in other words, what they're doing, there's not a single study that backs it up. But they've seen over time that it works, and it's based on a plausible underlying theory. And so they go forward with it. It's interesting to think about it, isn't it? And then we think about the standard of evidence for people based on the complete infancy, truly, of neuroscience, but particularly the domain of neuroscience that has to do with experience-dependent neuroplasticity. It is really in its infancy. On the other hand, if an intervention A has a plausible underlying mechanism physically within a Western science model, B is likely to do very little harm, and C seems to have immediate, subjective experiential benefit, then it seems to make plausible sense to me, to keep one's eyes open and proceed, including under the general heading of what the Buddha said a long time ago, see for yourself. So, inside that heading, Michael's work, I think, is very exciting. He's ticked off a list of who's who of other people that have really been developing great things. In my own work, I've been very interested in what I think of as a decent first draft of a basic kind of toolbox, for the mind-brain based on what's been known or, you know, in the last, or developed in the last 10 or 20 years, but it's truly a complete, you know, beginner's, you know, first draft, because I think that's really where we are. You know, I think medicine, or I should say, you know, neuroscience and kind of applied neuropsychology are where biology and medicine were 100 years or so after the invention of the microscope, let's say around 1710, you know, 300 years ago. So you think how far they've come in 300 years, and that to me gives us some hope as to where we're going to go 300 years from now. I would kind of flag a few headlines to try to bring it down to practicalities. One is to really appreciate the importance of paying attention to long-term, low-grade chronic stress. You know, Mother Nature helped us develop systems for dealing with acute stress in a context in which most people were dead by the time they're 35. I know I'm older than 35. I won't ask either of you how old you are, you know, if you're over the 35, but, you know, I want to live long and well. And so, you know, long-term chronic stress has massively pernicious consequences for physical and mental health. So to help people practically learn how to mount a calming response, you know, increase the preponderance of activation in the parasympathetic wing of the autonomic nervous system, for example, methods that help people do that, I think it's very important. Another big takeaway, I think, is developing a growing capacity to call up the felt sense of being cared about by others and the felt sense of belonging. You know, the social brain hypothesis is the notion that's been developed, really been developing, I should say, in the last 10 years with a lot of momentum. It's the idea that, you know, one of the main driving shaping forces of the evolution of the human brain, certainly over the last several million years in terms of our hominid ancestors and primate ancestors, and then in the last several hundred thousand years, has been the reproductive advantages, you know, the engine of biological evolution of social skills or love, you know, broadly defined. So finding a way, particularly in our extremely fragmented, schizoid sort of world, particularly in the West, you know, that we live in, finding a way to activate that felt sense of being cared about, I think is really important. And then the last one I'll just mention here in passing is the importance of internalizing positive experiences. I think that, you know, there's a lot of work that's been done on the negativity bias of the brain. There's a few exceptions to it, you know, the ways in which some people have a positivity bias. But generally speaking, the default setting is a kind of negativity bias, which among its many features immediately stores negative experiences with sort of dedicated systems, as it were, but uses, generally speaking, normal memory systems, unless it's a million-dollar moment, to register positive experiences, which means that unless they're really held in awareness 10, 20, 30 seconds in a row, and also with repetition, they tend to sift through the mind, you know, or the brain, really, like water through a sieve. That's why I think that helping people become more proactive to deliberately and consciously internalize positive experiences so that they become resources over time and implicit memory, I think is another specific thing that people can really focus on that will make a difference in their experience of living.
And Michael, do you have a response from your personal experience and your research on what sort of filters down into everyday life in terms of practices that help with well-being?
Well, I think that I would begin with wanting to live a life that's meaningful and that is of service to others. And whether that life is eventually long or short, that it actually be one oriented as much as possible to others. And I want to stress that this is a very, very much an ongoing and largely a stop-and-go project for my own life, and I'm not at all claiming to have reached this, but this is something that I think very, very much about, and that's also what motivates my own work, and which is why I focused on practices such as metta, centering prayer, and some of the yogic practices where the wisdom traditions have actually made strong claims to their transformative power, and the transformative power generally is first and foremost about one's own responsiveness to the people who one wants to reach out to and love. And I would say that what one has to remember is that when we're making claims from the neuroscience fields, from the neuroscientific fields, we do have, as Rick very rightly said, these standards of evidence, and that's true whenever we want to try and claim anything about how some practice affects the brain, or how focusing on these thoughts rather than these thoughts actually affects the neural networks. If we're not able to point to published peer-reviewed evidence about that, we should really not be making those claims. But that does not mean that we don't have abundant evidence from our own personal experience, from the experience of our teachers and of the wisdom traditions, both religious and secular, to which we actually can turn in order to provide us guidance and for our lives, for the daily practices in which we engage. So I would be very, very enthusiastic about people continuing to work with trained and well-respected teachers, both in religious and secular contexts, in developing ways in which they can be more loving to each other, to themselves. And I would just express strong willingness and strong suggestion that when we make claims about the brain, we really try and work within the standards of evidence of the peer-reviewed literature, because otherwise the danger is that we'll make claims that will later turn out to be so right. We will then undermine trust in the claims that we make. We will undermine trust by connection with the practices themselves, which would be terrible. And we might undermine the trust in the future of this research, which I find so promising. I think caution now, in terms of the scientific claims, and the scientific claims primarily, will reap great rewards in the future. I think being exciting and enthusiastic all the same about the science and about seeking out well-respected, qualified teachers, this is, for me, I think, where the abstract becomes very practical.
Great. Well, this might be a good time to open the conversation to callers, Stephen.
Sure. So you can either touch one on your keypad if you have a question, and we can take some live questions, or if you're on the webcast, type them in. I see various ones already. Dax said, in yesterday's discussion, empathy was suggested to potentially have some long-term negative effects on energy or well-being, especially in caregivers, whereas compassion potentiates that. Wondering if you can explain that through neuropsychophysiology. Sorry.
I can take a quick stab at that, and then maybe, or Rick, do you want to go ahead?
No, I think, Michael, that's really really central to your own work, so I'd love to hear what you have to say about it.
Okay, well, that's a great question, let me say that it's because, as Rick said, empathy is not so much an emotion, but as Rick said, it's a process. It's a process by which in our own brains, in our own minds, we become more affected by, and we actually run simulations about the suffering that other people are going through. And it can lead to a number of different paths. As Rick suggested, if you want to be a very good interrogator, perhaps it's going to help if you can read the other person's mind incredibly effectively, and perhaps in doing that you would be relying on empathy. So it can head in that direction. It can also head in a direction which leads us to, in the terms of a long-term caregiver, always be worried about, because of these constant signals that we're getting, oh, that the person that I'm caring for must be in pain. They must have very little hope. They must be very sad. And as we're thinking these, and as we're even unconsciously caring for the person and just looking at their face and seeing, I've been a hospital chaplain, and so I have great respect for and admiration for the work that physicians, nurses, caregivers provide, even within families, for their loved one. My mom is a nurse in an elder care facility, absolutely devoted to the people that she cares for there. I have great respect and great admiration for these individuals. And you can imagine that these individuals will look at a person's face for whom they're caring, will see the contortions of the body, and will be immediately aware of the possibilities of pain, suffering, et cetera. And I think it's in this way that empathy can actually lead to fatigue, lead to actual the kind of stress that Rick was talking about, and be maladaptive, be dysfunctional in the very long chronic run. At the same time, compassion is a kind of approach that we don't have, I should say, at this point in time, as nearly as good an understanding of neurally as we do for processes of empathy. But that said, I'll give you a concrete example. A recent study, 2009, came out looking at surveys of patients with locked-in syndrome. So they can't really move, they can't speak, et cetera, but they can respond via electronic means that are set up for them, et cetera. And it was uniformly found that family members and friends of these individuals rated these individuals' quality of life much lower than the individuals did themselves, as long as those individuals were within loving relationships and had social support. So if you're according to this research, if you're a person with locked-in syndrome and you have social support, then you actually rate your quality of life much higher than, in fact, the people around you who are giving you that support. So that's an indication of where empathy and the process of imagining and simulating what it must be like for the other has taken too much hold and perhaps might be interfering with compassion. And compassion is really about recognizing that one's own presence, one's turning one's face toward the face of another in need, sometimes is all that one can do and is all that is needed, taking up a person's hand in pain. Richie Davidson has done some very nice work showing that simply holding another person's hand reduces the signals of pain from the brain that that person is undergoing when undergoing a painful stimulus. Just realizing this and being mindful of the gift of one's presence to another person, rather than trying to always reimagine and perhaps get completely wrong the sad state of the other. This is, I think, the difference between processes of empathy, which can build up into chronic stress, and processes of compassion, which again focus on the relation and on the gift of one face to another face.
Great answer. Another webcast question I thought is kind of fun is, how little daily meditation can help reduce stress levels? So somebody wants to know, what's the minimum threshold here?
Rick, you want to take that one?
Well, if I could, I wanted to build on what you said there, Michael, just about empathy and caregiver burnout.
Sure.
And compassion. And a quick point about it, kind of a two-parter. One is to appreciate it, you know, as Michael knows much better than I mean, I'm a clinician, I'm a methods guy, and that's kind of my main focus. I consume research, I don't produce any, but anyway, you know, social science research is on the averages of groups, essentially, and then I think we need to be very careful about generalizing from that group finding, as it were, to all individuals who comprise the group, because, you know, all humans are very, very different from all molecules of water. You know, if you can discover one thing about a group of molecules of water, you can pretty plausibly apply that to every member of that population. But just because you discover, let's say, for example, a difference between the average man and the average woman, doesn't mean that that finding applies to all members of that each set, you know, all men or all women. So in that sense, I think that it's interesting to think about the subgroup of caregivers who do not burn out and yet who seem to have, as Michael was getting at, you know, very touchingly, a high level of empathy and compassion for the people that they work with. And that takes me to kind of the second part of this answer, which has to do with the notion of equanimity. I think that, you know, that's where, you know, to use Buddhism as a kind of springboard here in the what are considered to be these four aspects of an awakened person, compassion, kindness, joy at the good fortune of others, and empathy, and equanimity. Equanimity is seen as the foundation, you know. Equanimity means that we allow the world to move through us, but it doesn't knock us over. I think of equanimity as sort of like a deep keel in the water. So I think about what might be going on in the minds of caregivers, let's say, who are very empathic and very compassionate, yet remain equanimous. And I think one of the things that supports equanimity is a sense of boundaries, because some of the research, as Michael knows, on empathy has shown that people who have very porous boundaries, including they're just you know, very sensitive or overwhelmed by the experience of others, have a difficult time sustaining empathy because they're just bowled over, you know. So I think that's one thing that supports equanimity, that paradoxically, you know, in this sense, fences do make for good neighbors, enable people to sustain caregiving over the long haul, you know, without getting so burned out. And I think another one is a certain fundamental capacity to regulate their own affective response so that they don't get just blown away by the feelings that get stirred up in them. You know, they feel enough. Obviously, they're not cold or indifferent, but they don't feel so much that, you know, they get fried, you know, over time. Okay, with regard to meditation, well, this is a fast food nation, you know. I think it's fast meditation nation. There is the famous book, The One-Minute Meditator. You know, the research that I've read on meditation does imply that there is, in general terms, a dosing effect. And whether or not that dosing effect is purely linear, or whether or not there's a threshold, you know, even above or below, where such, for example, you need to engage a certain minimum at the low end of the threshold possibility to get the effect, or, you know, practice past a certain point starts to hit a ceiling in terms of diminishing returns. I'm not exactly sure about that. I think I would say that from my direct experience and from observing other people, that if a person is willing to make a fundamental commitment to never go to bed without meditating at least 1 minute or more a day, that's something people tell me is beneficial to them. I'm using the word meditation here quite broadly. It would include for me things like prayer in a more theistic frame or doing things in a not theistic frame. It would include, I think, you know, sincerely mindful practice of walking. So I'm broadening it out a bit. That said, I think, you know, the more you do, the better it's going to be. And it's important to appreciate that it's really okay to modify practice to suit your own temperament. There is neurological diversity. I sometimes think about, you know, the temperamental spectrum running from turtles at one end, you know, to jackrabbits at the other, and that most contemplative practices, historically, I think, have been developed by turtles for turtles to make them better turtles in turtle pens, you know, turtle tanks. And yet, these days, there are a lot of people who are more spirited or jackrabbity in their temperament and or have grown up in a kind of a jackrabbit culture in which they've grown used to very high levels of incoming stimulation and feel uneasy if they don't get that much. And so for them, I think it's okay to, you know, as appropriate, to alter traditional instructions to increase the stimulation rate, including doing things like, you know, meditating while walking or focusing on the breath all over the body and not just at one location like around the upper lip. So all that said, the last thing I'll say real fast is that, you know, in addition to whatever people get from the practice itself, I think very often the main benefit is the nonspecific element that are present, that if often historically been lumped under the so-called placebo effect, but it's actually not a placebo at all. They're just non-specific. You know, they're not associated with the particular treatment, as it were, that's been studied. And so, for example, the non-specific effect that associates with meditating is that you're taking a stand for your own well-being. You know, you're on your own side, and you're also creating a kind of sanctuary. If only 1 minute long, ideally longer, you know, 10, 20, 30 minutes longer, ideally, but you're creating a sanctuary in your life for yourself and what matters most to you. So that has a lot of impact as well.
Great. Why don't we go to a live questioner? How about Lindsay? Lindsay.
Well, yes. Yes, this is Lindsay. And I'm kind of a 63-year-old who's been on a long path. I've been a sociologist, a pre-med student, an anthropologist, a filmmaker, a television producer, and now I'm a healing touch practitioner. And what I've been amazed by in this panel is specifically the incredible amount of gobbledygook, which to me means that you guys are so enmeshed in your language of research that I wonder if you are you out really among people? Because I'm hearing, you know, for me, what's important is when I'm out doing, I'm building a healing touch program in a local hospital now, because I needed to introduce them to that as a complementary therapy. What I find is that lack of evidence is not evidence of lack. And so I'm hearing you say that if we don't see it in the brain, it's almost not happening. And yet I find in the real world that's not what we need to be doing today. So would you address the fact of this, all this brain research, and how we get back to something that will really help our society to come back to, and to me it has a lot to do with the fact that the cultural underpinnings of any kind of cultural peace have been, you know, scattered to the winds. Can you address that? I mean, I know it's rather broad, but...
Yeah, so this is Michael, Lindsay, and I actually very much appreciate your question, and very much appreciate you, the directness that you have, and want to thank you for that. I agree with you, and what I was saying about claims, I was trying to advocate for the importance of anecdotal experience and one's own experience within relation, close relation, with colleagues that you happen to be working with at the hospital, with your own clients, your own patients, and not to wait for neuroscience to come along and tell you, yes, this is exactly what you should be doing. I was only suggesting that we don't make those kinds of claims about, well, it's happening this way in the brain and that way in the brain until we have very clear peer-reviewed literature. I was not at all suggesting that people in your position, certainly not my mom who treats people and who works with people as a very well-respected, dedicated nurse who absolutely loves the people she cares for, I was not expecting or trying to claim that you in the trenches should sit on the sidelines until we neuroscientists have the right answer. Quite the opposite, and that was the point I was trying to make. And I can tell you in my work as a chaplain, I've introduced centering prayer into practice in my patient visits and also among staff. And it does. I mean, the anecdotal reports are, this was very helpful. Thank you very much. This helps. It's the only quiet moment of my day, and we spent 5 minutes doing it. I mean, the caller about how much helps. I completely agree 100% with Rick's answer. Try to do it every day, even if you can only do it for 30 seconds or 60 seconds. More regular is better than more time and less regular. And so I appreciate your question very much, Lindsay, and I am sorry that the way that I had communicated my previous comments led you to believe that I was saying that what you and others like you are doing is irrelevant. It's absolutely 180 degrees opposite from that, and I appreciate your allowing me to clarify.
The whole thing, it certainly wasn't your comments. I got that you were, you know, swimming upstream there. Thank you very much for that. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
But Veronica.
I just wanted to say thank you so much. It's been incredibly informative. I, too, have been a chaplain, hospice, hospital chaplain, dean, minister, et cetera, coming from private sector into not-for-profit. And the walk right through has been one of compassion, empathy, and I've experienced burnout. So I just thank you for hitting home.
Great.
Thank you very much, Veronica. Is this Veronica?
Yes.
Thank you very much, Veronica. That's very kind of you to come on and give us that message of support and thanks. Appreciate that.
Great. Another webcast question here was about the had to do with the negative experiences. So actually, let me scroll down here. It says, why is the brain not wired in a more neutral position so that it would be just as easy to retain the positive as well as the negative?
Great question.
Probably a great question for Rick.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, a two-parter here. I think one part is that, how can I put this? In my own view, the resting state of the brain, when people are not in trouble, they're not in pain, they're not threatened, they're not chemically disturbed, they're not hungry, and so forth, they're not, you know, kicked out of their group, the brain tends to default to a nice place. You know, it gets at some of the fundamental questions that have preoccupied philosophers for a long time. You know, are we fundamentally, you know, good or bad, you know, happy or sad, you know, people? And, you know, for me, at the root, in terms of three fundamental motivational systems that have evolved over time in the brain in somewhat in parallel to the evolution of the vagus nerve, but not tightly entwined with that, you know, we have these systems that both, number one, avoid threats or pain, number two, approach rewards and pleasure, and number three, laid on top of that, especially with mammals and birds, and then particularly primates and humans, you know, we want to attach to us, quote-unquote. So in terms of those three systems, I think when people, the evidence is that when people are, as I said, not disturbed, when they're not perturbed, they default into a state in terms of the avoiding system of being relatively calm, the approaching system relatively content, and the attaching system quite caring. That's the brain, I think, of in its responsive mode. On the other hand, Mother Nature evolved hair trigger mechanisms to drive us from that resting state at the crackle of a twig, you know, in the Serengeti a couple of million years ago, or today, you know, a frown across a dinner table, or someone making a rude gesture on the car next to us with their hand, a rude gesture with their hand in a car next to us on the freeway. And so then we kick into more of a reactive mode, which includes, for example, fight or flight responses that you know, are associated with, you know, unpleasant feelings as well as negative effects long-term on the body and mind. So in terms of all that, so that's how I think about it. And the thing about the negativity bias and why the brain is kind of preferentially organized around registering negative experiences is simply because in evolution, while carrots were important, sticks tended to be both more urgent and have more impact. In other words, if you fail to get a carrot today, you probably have a chance at one tomorrow. But if you fail to avoid a stick today, whap, you know, no more carrots forever. So there are a variety of ways, and people, you know, we're all done. You'll talk about our websites, I think. And on my website, freely offered are the slide sets from a number of workshops in which I have a number of slides that go into detail about the negativity bias. But anyway, it functions in a number of ways, including, frankly, in terms of memory systems. To kind of simplify it, the brain is like Velcro for negative experiences, but Teflon for positive ones. That's why I think the opportunity is for people in very practical ways to really use mindfulness to as almost a kind of concentration practice to savor, as Martin Seligman has talked about, to really savor their positive experiences, including what are mainly mildly positive experiences, but to routinely half a dozen times a day savor those experiences so they sink in. You know, they stick to your mental ribs, as it were.
Interesting. But a question from JoJo, who's on the live line.
Thank you. Gentlemen, I'm wondering if you can give some guidance to all of us out here in terms of who is doing the clinical research on energetic modalities in specifically the cases of people with neurobiological difficulties, depression, obsessive-compulsive disorder, the one that's rampant now, which is attention deficit disorder, all of those neurobiostructurally and biochemically driven difficulties, who is doing research on what these modalities are doing and how much they're doing and why it is that they seem to have a really quite a temporary and, I guess I would say, ephemeral impact on people with these kinds of problems?
Well, this is Cassie. I would just, I'll start with that to say, first of all, that's a really huge question because there are dozens of labs right now doing research on all kinds of interventions clinically for depression and ADHD and anxiety and all kinds of autism. And one of the great references that I would refer you to, which is a little bit old now, but it's not too old, it's about a year old, is Sharon Begley, who wrote a book called, I think, Training Your Brain or Train Your Brain, which kind of reviews a lot of that research, and it's a good place to start. And I think that, you know, interestingly, what we're finding is that some of the effects are not quite as temporary or ephemeral as you might imagine. So I just heard yesterday of a third replication of a study using mindfulness-based cognitive therapy for people who have had depression many times, and it is equivalent or exceeding the effects of antidepressants in helping people not relapse into depression. There's some great work at UCLA where they're working with ADHD kids and autistic kids using neurofeedback mechanisms that utilize attention and sort of mindfulness-based components that have been really helpful. You might also look into the work of Daniel Siegel, who is another person at the MindSight Institute, who is a really good person who synthesizes a lot of this work. And then Rick Hansen, who's on this call, has a website. I think, Rick, is it wisebrain.org?
Yeah, people can also just go to buddhasbrain.com, and that'll take
you
there.
Yeah, so buddhasbrain.com or wisebrain.org is a great place to go to look at sort of a synthesis of the kinds of research that's happening in this area. And I would agree with Michael that although it's frustrating, we really are in our infancy right now in terms of the neuroscience of well-being. So what we can say, I think, maybe it's not infancy, maybe it's toddlerhood, or maybe it's early childhood in this field, where we can say, wow, there's some really promising effects of these mindfulness-based or contemplative interventions for these kinds of clinical issues that people are facing. There's some really good work right now happening with chronic pain. One of the colleagues that I was at a party with the other night, two nights ago, is Richard Miller, who has developed a program called iREST, which has now been adopted by the Walter Reed Army Medical Center. And so now every soldier who's returning from the Middle East is being offered not only antidepressants for their PTSD, but they're also being offered this contemplative practice program, which is proving to be similar, if not better, than antidepressants or cognitive behavioral therapy. So I'd say that, you know, there are some very, very promising results right now around these practices, and much more research needs to be done, and probably my other panelists can also speak to this.
I'll just speak, this is Michael, just speak very briefly and then let Rick get in here. I would say if you check out mbct.com and the work of Zindel Siegel, who is at the University of Toronto, along with the other kind of co-founders of mindfulness-based cognitive therapy. This has been actually shown. There are a couple of books out now, and more importantly, to my mind, many peer-reviewed papers that show longer-term successes with staving off symptoms of depression, including in people who don't respond very well to medication. So I would say that, in fact, as I would really emphasize what Cassie is saying, there is mounting evidence that bringing mindfulness and mindfulness-based practices into clinical therapy, it has great promise for actually enhancing the and perhaps prolonging the freedom from symptoms of depression, anxiety, even chronic pain, psoriasis. Jon Kabat-Zinn has published on psoriasis. So very shortly, there's a lot that's there that's promising, and you could find more at mbct.com, mindfulness-based cognitive therapy.
Rick here. I think those are both great responses, and I would really not have much to add to them.
Well, gentlemen and Cassie, it's we're about 4 minutes left here, so I want to make sure that folks who have been stimulated by everything you've shared, it's been really fascinating and quite insightful, they are able to stay in contact with you. So what we can do is anybody, let's start with Rick, let's say. So anybody who would like us to share your email with Rick, just to for his email list to kind of keep you up to date on his latest activities and articles and releases, you can press 1, and Rick, maybe talk a little about anything you have coming up.
Oh, very briefly, if people do give me their email address, number one, I'll never share it with anybody else, that's for sure, and you can always unsubscribe. But I'll send you the monthly Wise Brain Bulletin that comes from the Wellspring Institute for Neuroscience and Contemplative Wisdom. And also I'll subscribe to this newsletter I do with a weekly practice. It's called Just One Thing. It really comes from my heart. It's very down to earth, and it's been actually quite popular. At this point, over 14,000 people have subscribed to it. And so I just send it out freely, no strings attached. And, for example, the practice that's going out right now is to speak wisely. A recent one was you notice that you're all right now. Others have included things like, you know, taking the good, things like that. So that's what will happen, as you know, if people give me their email address, which I respect highly. I don't like spam, you know, and so I take really good care of people's email addresses.
Great. So again, if you are on the webcast, you can just type one into the window there for questions, and we can grab it from there too. So, Michael, how about you? If folks touch 2, if you'd like us to share email in a similar way with Michael, just to keep up to date. And Michael, what kind of stuff do you have on the horizon?
Well, yeah, first of all, I'd like to say that I'm a scholar. I do research. So if people just want to send me their comments, if they want to ask a question, I'm not going to respond unless you want me to. I will not share your emails with anyone. And if you have just a comment that you want to send and you don't want a response from me, that's fine. I'm very interested in what people think and would be happy to answer in more detail any questions people have. For what's coming up on the horizon, continuing work in the basics of moral action and how the brain helps us recognize moral situations and how that might actually differ among individuals, as well as how contemplative practice might contribute to the fostering of a virtuous character. And also a collaborative engagement with Professors Andrew Dreitzer and Frank Rogers at the Claremont School of Theology. It's part of the Center for Engaged Compassion there. We're going to be gathering together some scientists, contemplative practitioners, and scholars of practitioners to try and build some new understanding, new shared understandings about ways in which we can scientifically approach these practices that are acceptable, that are welcome to the people who actually engage and teach the practices, as well as to the religious studies scholars who have devoted so much of their intellect and their lives to studying the practices. So that's exciting things that I'm looking forward to.
Great stuff. And Cassie, since you're with IONS and we're actually co-producing this summit, people will be updated on IONS stuff, but anything particular that you have on the horizon you want to let people know about?
Well, I think you can just reach me at noetic.org, and there is a wealth of information there about all kinds of different aspects of what we've been talking about, and kind of apropos the comment of the person a couple of comments back. You know, I think it's really important to remember that when we talk about neuroscience, this has been, I would say a somewhat conservative discussion of what we know about the neuroscience of well-being. And so, I would say the summary is it's promising. There is mounting evidence that contemplative practice and attention and intentional practices affect not only our well-being but our brains and our bodies, and there's a whole lot more to learn about it. And there is also a wealth of evidence from the spiritual traditions and from people's experiences in the health and healing professions. And we try to do a good job at the Institute of Noetic Sciences in bringing all of that wisdom together into one place. And so please go to noetic.org to find out more.
Great. Well, it's been really an illuminating and fascinating discussion. I thank all of you for joining in Next Evolution of Health this weekend.
Thanks, Stephen.
Thank you very much for having us here.
Yes, thanks very much, Stephen. Really appreciate it.
Great. Yeah, we look forward to more in the future. So for folks who are, we just have one more session this today, and it's going to start in an hour. It's going to feature Norm Shealy and Chris Hibbard, and we're going to look at new innovations in self-healing. And for those who would like to connect with each other between now and then, you're welcome to do that. All you have to do is touch one on your keypad right now, and that'll let us know that you'd like to be put into some smaller groups, and so you can have some discussion about what you've heard or whatever's on your heart and mind. We want to make sure that the folks, especially there's a lot of healthcare providers and practitioners who have been drawn to this summit, so if you're sharing what you're applying in your practice or what's where your growing edges are, that can be very helpful and useful. So, again, just touch one if you'd like to stay in those discussion groups. And if not, we'll hopefully see you at 3:30 for our final, or 4:30 for our final session. And really deep bow of gratitude to all of you for participating and helping make this possible. Thank you very much, and see you in an hour.